companions. We help you discover your many layers. You peel, you cry, you wake up with fresh eyes. Question life, question humanity, question society, but most of all, question yourself.
Helen is an interdisciplinary artist researcher with the Culture of City Center, board member with the Center for Social Innovation, and a Salzburg Global Fellow. She leads the Laboratory for Artistic Intelligence, which develops experimental applications of artistic intelligence for society, particularly in matters of public policy. We're happy to have Helen on this episode of Onions Talk.
Hello, my name is Helen Jung, and I am the founder and chief artistic officer of the Laboratory for Artistic Intelligence. My self-introduction. I often say I'm an interdisciplinary artist researcher. I wear a lot of different hats. I always say the most concrete thing, that relatable thing that people know, is that I design set and costumes for theater. That's also meant that I make interactive work, and I design exhibitions. Increasingly, it kind of is a form of curation as well. I do consulting, mainly in the cultural sector. I also a bit in the nonprofit sector. And I've had the pleasure of serving on the board of directors for the Center for Social Innovation, and also the sister charity, the foundation. And alongside the consulting, I've done research as well. Most recently, I advised on the creation or the development of the evaluation framework for creative hubs for the Department of Canadian Heritage.
So it's so varied and it's so interdisciplinary. How did art making lead to social innovation consulting, being on boards, and all of these research projects? What was the connection? How did it progress to all of the things that you're doing?
I think that there's sort of at least two sections to that, to the answer to that question. On the technical, empirical level, when I was working, I think for a lot of artists, when you're being an artist, you also work in arts management. And so when I was an arts manager, I participated in a number of professional development and organizational development workshops, and they were hosted by a company called Creative Trust here in Toronto. And that they were a part of the Center for Social Innovation. And that was when the center was just, CSI was just starting. They had, I believe it was 1,100 square foot on the ground floor of this building. And so the workshops were held there, and that's how I knew about CSI. And they, I had a bit of vibe about it. And so I inquired early on about hot desking, about getting an office there. It wasn't within reach, it was there in my mind. And then my arts management work took me eventually to Montreal, where I was one of the two founding consultants that worked on the launch of a pan-Canadian cultural participation campaign. I did that, and just as we were launching, I was like, okay, I need to come back to Toronto. I was commuting back and forth between the two cities every other week, and it was too much. My neck and shoulders were not happy. And so I moved back to Toronto, and I knew that CSI had just bought a building, and I put my name on the list and was like, I want an office there. And so it was a dedicated desk. So it was an open concept desk is what that meant. And it was great. I had it. The reality of it a year later was that I was really never there. I was always somewhere else at rehearsal, in a meeting. And so that at the same time meant that I met, some other people. This was the Culture City Center that was inside of the Center for Social Innovation. They invited me into their research center because I was saying that I was going to give up my desk, but gosh, I don't want to do it because it's nice to have a place to hang my hat, so to speak, when I do come into the office. And they were like, well, come join us, you know. So that sort of happened, and really at the end, around that same time, I guess I had landed my first major research paper for the Network of Canadian Public Arts Funders. And so it really cemented the research piece. I was already doing research, but it was more artistic research. I had gotten some seed money from an arts council to take artists into shopping malls. And how did that happen? That came out of living up to my own expectations or my own demands, I guess. I had been invited to speak on a panel for something called the Magnetic North Theatre Festival. I guess this was in 2010. And it was about building audiences. And, you know, I was so busy then. We were launching this national campaign, and I'm sitting on the bus on my way to, I think it was Hamilton that we were in, or Kingston, or it must have been Waterloo. I don't know. We were somewhere out of town. And on that bus, I'm like furiously, like, you know, just writing my notes for this talk I was going to give. And I guess I was so tired of the equity questions at this point, because I had been working for Culture Days, that national campaign that was very much about building audiences for arts and culture. And at the same time, I was working in equity for the Canada Council for the Arts. And so I'm like sitting on this bus, and I just... the only answer I had for people, and I gave it when I stood up to speak, was that if you wanted diverse audiences, you would have them already. If you wanted my aunts and uncles to come to your shows, like, you would have them already. You know where they live. You know where they shop. Go get them. I was talking about going into shopping malls to... see how you would engage people artistically there. And so I was like, okay, I gotta do it. So I did it. And so that was the very first time, I guess, I was officially doing truly arts-driven research. It was very experimental. It was very indeterminate. I didn't know what we were gonna get, and I really had no expectations about what would be a good outcome. It was really interesting. And God bless those artists who came and, you know, participated.
What kind of interventions did you do in the shopping mall?
I wouldn't call them necessarily interventions. It was that open, because I didn't want to be prescriptive about why we were there. It was about being, like, the initial core group of artists I brought in were... older artists that I really respected and had a really deep practice. And also I knew they were unafraid, you know, these were strong women. And I said, just bring your artist self, bring your sensibilities, your curiosities and your sensitivities and your sort of toolkit, and like come and do whatever it is you want in the mall. And there were like a range of responses at different points in time, you know, like, I'd really have to check my notes, but so I don't want to, you know, misrepresent what happened, but there were times where I realized, okay, people are not so happy with me. These artists are not so happy with me. And it's because there's this incredible feeling of vulnerability. And in a way, it was much harder for them, I realized, than for younger artists. And so in the end, like later on into the experiment, I brought in some younger artists, but to just like step out into the unknown was like, I mean, it would have been more conventional and more familiar to have an objective in mind, to call it an intervention, but it wasn't any of those things. I really was interested in, I guess now looking back, I guess that in many ways I was looking for that phenomenological gathering of, observations. And so, and which is what happened. It started with a, like, okay, this is what I'm observing about this place. And then people, you know, then people tried like very small actions, and sort of noticed what would happen there. And, And some of them built further into something a little bit more concrete, like I think Jean Yoon made something that had a title, and it was performance art, I think. Is she was going through something at the time too, so it really worked for her in the end to do that. I'm trying to remember. I feel like Andrea Nan did some things there that that continued to precipitate. She and I had a working relationship beyond that. Like one experiment we had for a number of years, we were working together, and I think that really sort of kept carrying through. Like, not to say that I wouldn't even call it a seed, I would just say that it was part of one's explorations or something, I don't know. Yeah, and like Brenda, hilariously, Brenda Joy Lem, my gosh, she's so soft-spoken, but like she has no fear. And she just kept like antagonizing the security guards. And this one guy at like the Chinese mall was just so upset with us. And we really, really, I felt bad how upset he was. I mean, like you'd think it was something personal, and all she did was go and sing a song at the top of the stairs. And I don't know why he was so upset, but personally. Anyway, so I'm sorry, I'm going around a bit in circles. This was to answer your question of how did all these things happen. So that was an example of doing, you know, what you might call pure arts-driven research. But I had done like some sort of more sociological readings around malls and like how they're constructed and how and what kinds of activities occur there other than shopping. And there's a lot, so much that happens in mall culture. It's amazing. Yeah, that was really interesting. And so coming back to that final part, you were asking how did arts then lead to being on the board of CSI? I don't know. I think at some point I received an email saying that CSI was looking for board members. And I guess, yes, throughout those years, so from way back when I was just an arts manager and like a very junior one at that, or in the eyes of everyone else, I was a very junior one. I remember standing in on the fourth floor of the Center for Social Innovation in their very first offices. We were in the kitchen and there was like some sort of celebratory toast for something or other. Might have been the opening of the fourth floor, I'm not sure, but Jeannie Stoke turned around and asked me, what do you think of this whole social enterprise business? And I said, well, if the definition of a social enterprise is an organization that they have both social goals, like social outcomes, as well as, you know, financial sustainability in mind. At the time, I think it was called off-balance sheet benefits or assets or what have you. And I just said that I think artists and arts organizations are the original social enterprise. And she said, huh. And we left it at that. But it stuck with me, that opinion. And throughout the years, it just really felt like the social change conversation, particularly the one led by what's called social innovation and social enterprise. I was still involved. I was involved in it in a number of different ways. Like there was also socialfinance.ca. They were running out of, I guess it was a project of the McConnell, it was a project of SIG, which was the Social Innovators Group, which was part of the McConnell Family Foundation, which was housed inside of Mars or had their offices inside of the Mars district. So it was all of those types gathered around this idea of social finance. And so this was when nobody knew what social finance was, and the person who was running it or had just started there, or I don't remember what his role was, but I knew him briefly from Montreal, and he invited me to come and help. He called it provide creative direction for this new microsite, this like social finance 101 portal that they wanted to create. And I said, well, you've got Bruce Mao here being your creative agency. I don't think you need another creative director, but I'm happy to take part. And so I did sit in on those and like helped help be an intermediary between the folks who were really, you know, who lived and breathed social finance and knew the material, and then these advertising people. And I sort of, yeah, sat in between and sort of understood a bit on both sides. And I'm sorry, I'm getting wishy-washy again, but
what is social finance? Can you elaborate that a bit more?
It's about, or these days it's about impact investing. So finance, like finance for business, except for in this case, social finance, like financing for social outcomes. Although in this, like what it really is about is investing or financing enterprises, not only for financial outcomes, but also for social outcomes. For them, it's social and financial at once. I guess theoretically financing social outcomes itself could be a thing, but I would say, I think that's rare. I think it's rare. I mean, that's just philanthropy is what they call it. So on a very technical sense, it started from just some workshops that I was there and, you know, stay connected and you're just swimming in those waters. And that was my pitch getting on the board. I just really wanted to make sure that the arts were at the table, part of this conversation. So I was saying that there's sort of two sections to that, to my answer for that. So that's the empirical, like, physically, how did I get involved? And then personally, I would say that, it's not a original story or anything. I'm someone who cares about social impact, who cares about making the world a better place. Yeah. And in the last few years, understanding that, I think in the beginning, it felt like two parallel things or two sort of separate worlds. And now with the Laboratory for Artistic Intelligence, it's more clear than ever, like, that for me, these things are connected. And so much of social innovation and change work, funders and other people requiring theories of change and these logic models. And it's funny because I've helped people write those things, and I'm good at it. But the reality is that as an artist, change and transformation happens in a much more organic way. And art is indirect. And I think the wisdom of artists and cultural practice and our cultural inheritance, all of that, I think that reductionist model of like saying that you can, you know, describe this linear path of we do these inputs and then have these outputs, which then lead to these outcomes, which then lead to these impacts. That's not acknowledging the dynamic, you could use that term interbeing, but the dynamic interconnectedness of everything. And interconnectedness still sounds too external in a way. It's truly, it's much more, I think I would say it's like much more quantum than that. We're now getting into topics that are like on the edge of my mind, but I really, probably I'm not prepared to speak about them.
No, but thank you for saying that. It was a very beautiful way of putting it. So like recently I've been thinking a lot about the value of the arts and if we as artists are expressing it enough or adequately, because I feel like in our art circle, you know, it's so easy to communicate these things, and you know, you instantly understand because you've been part of the artistic process, and you know what it's like to be genuine with your own emotions and to work on something and have that process where you start to understand yourself and in many ways yourself in relation to the rest of the world and society. And then when I try and communicate the value of the arts or the process of art making or that journey that is shared in social engagement with someone else, it's so difficult to explain it in a way that someone else who has never taken part in this process can understand. And then I've been recently thinking a lot about value and why is it that socially engaged artists find it so difficult to be paid for the work that they do, which brings about a lot of intrinsic value to the community that they're working with. And then I'm thinking about commodities and consumerism, where you know it's straightforward, like what you pay for a piece of clothing and then that's what you get. But then the value of the arts, it's how can you quantify or put a number or money to stuff like purpose, to stuff like passion, to stuff like human connection? Because putting a price on it almost just cheapens the experience. So I guess like these are just like sort of my thought process, which I saw a bit in what you were talking about. I guess you kind of learn maybe through university or like this is the art market, this is the path to be an artist, this is how you should do to brand yourself. But then actually there are ways to, you know, to balance all of it and juggle everything and be interdisciplinary and still be an artist and to have your own practice. I guess that's what I'm getting at. Like it's easy to see things as singular, as that if I'm doing this, then I have to just be doing this. But then actually, I guess the world out there it's a lot more interlinked, and that there are ways in which we could engage differently in different mediums or disciplines, but still, I guess, be able to still be an artist. Does that make sense?
Yes, I think there's absolutely always a way. I think that it comes down to who you are and who you become, who you're changing into, who you're growing into. I think that if you're going to a school that is good, that makes you feel good about showing you a pathway that works and you feel confident in it, sure, why not follow that path? But I think that the vast majority of arts programs out there, I don't know about fashion, but I would say the vast majority of arts programs, and how at this rate maybe all of higher education, is not good at showing you what is the pathway to a sustainable, you know, a financially feasible and satisfying, a self-actualizing, you know, future. So in the absence of that, in the absence of a clear pathway or a guaranteed road, you're going to have to invent anyway. So you might as well be inventing on your own behalf based on whatever your combination of interests, strengths, and areas that you're interested in growing yourself, and you design your own pathway. If you're an artist, then all the better. You can be an artist about your pathway. I think that, just do it. Do it in a way that doesn't, you know, do harm to others or to yourself, but just do it.
I remember when I was in university, I think it was my final year, and I was asking my tutors, like, how am I going to be financially sustainable in my work? How am I going to be financially sustainable in my art? What kind of jobs are out there? Like, and they just told me they don't know. And I feel like that's a lot of a reality out there, but I think there is a lot of value in arts education, because like I was talking recently to a close friend of mine, Liz, and we were just talking about the value of the arts, and it's about this personal journey that is actually really deep, and it I think in the years that I was in university, it wasn't so much about what I could learn from my professors. The professors weren't really there all the time. It was really about the exchange, the collaboration, the things that I learned from my peers, and also about understanding myself when going through that sort of artistic journey and process. And then also understanding society, understanding, I guess, also social justice, or the sort of conversations in activism, or, you know, about race, about colonization, or about gender, about identity, and about social awareness. And all of that was something that was so precious, that became the way that I saw the world. It became my worldview, but it also gave me the openness to see the world in a way where I can be responsible and accountable as a person to the rest of the world of different social class or different social backgrounds. And then that, I guess, juxtaposed with this narrative of, like, why would you pursue an arts education? What can you even do after graduation? And I feel like there is a lot more from what is learned there that can be contributed to society. And I guess this is kind of what I'm getting at. Like, how can we make it clearer for people, or even just ourselves, that these values or this learning can be a good contribution to society, and in what ways it can be done? It's a very broad question.
It is a very broad question. I don't think there's one size that fits all. I think experiencing it is the best way to believe something. So I think that putting people into situations where they're experiencing the positive effects of artistic practice, of socially engaged art, and artists engaged with society. Those are all, you know, I think a friend of mine said to me, an older friend, a respected artist, said to me a long time ago, when you do good work, people notice, which, and, you know, at the time I probably was like, I don't feel noticed. But it's true, which is not to say that if you're not being noticed, your work is terrible, but that there are things preventing you from getting noticed. And so there are, like, I think that for all that, absolutely, there are huge systemic barriers for different populations. Some are more targeted and more discriminatory than others. But for all that these barriers exist in our systems, in order to continue on, I have to believe that we have agency. Otherwise, what's the point? It's, you know, it's like, it's akin to freedom and determinism. It's like, you have to believe that it has impact, that what you do matters, the choices you make matter. And so, yeah, I choose to believe. I choose to believe that the better I choose, the better, the harder, not harder, but the better I work, it will matter. It will mean something. And at the very end of the day, no, I wouldn't say even at the end of the day, in every activity I do, I very much look for how does this fulfill me in order to do that. So even when it comes to grant writing or report writing, I approach it from the perspective of how does this feed me? And there's always a way. There's always a way to do the most mundane, uninteresting, or even painful thing in a way that feeds yourself. And that is the most important thing you should think about.
Mm-hmm. Can I know more about how the Laboratory for Artistic Intelligence was started?
Yeah, well, it depends on when you believe it started. I got some seed money to work with newcomers in a really different way, in a way that I guess now I would just describe as conceptual art. Because at the time I knew it wasn't community art in the traditional sense, and it wasn't even just socially engaged art in many ways. Yeah, I started doing that. I got the seed money in 2016. So that was when I registered an organization, a business. And at the time it was called Creative Decent Work, because partly I was trying to work following the decent work principles that, you can read about it on the internet, decent work principles. I knew about them from my relationship with the Ontario Nonprofit Network, and I started in 2016, and it was called something else. And then when I got new funding in 2019, last year, I had been wanting to rename it for years. I mean, when I picked the name at the beginning, I was like, I do not like this name. But I just didn't know what I wanted. And, you know, things take time. It was last year. I guess I was in Vancouver. I was talking to some new people. What is her name? Loretta Todd. She's a Indigenous media artist, and so we were meeting up for the first time. I won't even explain how we got connected, but we were having a great conversation with her and her team, and then they had been sharing all this stuff about themselves, and then they turned around and asked, well, what do you do? And in that moment, like, it just sort of, I don't know, this always happens, like, you talk to people and then for some reason the construction of that conversation leads you to articulate your thoughts in a different way. And so that was the first time I really used the words artistic intelligence to describe the work. I had earlier that year, I think in March, thought about naming the company Artistic Intelligence, but when I had checked at the time that it was like the domain was like, it was going to cost me an arm and a leg to buy it. And so I was like, okay, I'm not naming it that because I'm not about to spend that much money. But that summer, so like, I guess that was like 4 months later, I really knew why it needed to be called that. And it still took me a little while. I mean, as an artist, it was like, oh my God, why am I? but I had a friend, actually, a new friend that I was living with in a residency up in the Yukon. And she really encouraged me she said, I think you got to do it. And so I bit the bullet and I did it. I bought some virtual real estate. and I'm glad I did. I felt it was much more important to buy that piece of that domain name than it was to incorporate with, you know, the name protection and all that wouldn't matter if I had the domain. So it was a business decision. So whether you think we've started in 2016 or 2019, there you are. I guess I would say it feels like a no-brainer, like all things that, like all good choices, it feels like a no-brainer in the end. When I told my colleagues and friends the name of my new practice, my new organization, they were like, oh, that makes so much sense. All these different spheres that, you know, these different balls, plates I had been spinning in the air, suddenly they all locked together and it made a lot of sense that they were all part of one and the same. So I don't know. We're still, whether it was 2016 or 2019 when we started, we're still figuring it out. It's still very much in startup mode.
Can you give some examples of the things that you do at the Institute for Artistic Intelligence?
Yeah, so we've continued with our work around immigration. That has been very much our signature project because I was working on it. It's where we started. So that ranges from making art to doing social research to also doing advocacy or policy informing work. And all three of those are simultaneously happening most of the time. I guess the social research and the artistic work, the artistic production, those are more lock in step. The policy piece often comes a little bit later, but you know, it just sort of weaves in and out. We were supposed to have a pop-up exhibition, a multi-site exhibition this year at Luminato, which is an international arts and culture festival in Toronto. Because of COVID, that got canceled, but they had a virtual festival, which we ended up making a video mix for. It was a 30-minute long video mix sharing, you know, an inside look at our process, but also original music that had been created and some other stuff. You can check it out on our website. So that was like the artistic piece. And then out of that whole process, at the same time, we were gathering up all this social research, which then just a couple weeks ago, I think it's just over 2 weeks ago, we had to submit some policy recommendations to the Department of Immigration, which we gladly did. I'm supposed to be working on finalizing the public version of that so that we can publish that. So that's a policy piece. Other times we've done policy stuff, it was more like we got invited to speak on a panel or like at a conference where there was an overwhelming amount of assistant deputy ministers. It was an election year. So that's the immigration piece. We're also doing some work in health, mainly about sharing practice, like sharing artistic practice and discovering how that impacts tracking, evaluating the impact of creative practice on quote unquote non-artists. I don't like to label people as non-artists, but it's the easiest way to distinguish between the kinds of populations we mean, I guess. And that work is being done with the Canadian Mental Health Association. We're going to be running a 6-week program early next year in the middle of winter, February to March, to get people through their winter blues. And the partnership with CMHA there is on the evaluation piece. And the other project we're working on is, it's on better futures. Right now I'm focused mostly on working with BIPOC people, Black, Indigenous, people of color, artists and arts organizations. So we're working in partnership with Black Lives Matter Toronto. Our intention is to offer a program. The program is being done in the programming itself. The content is being done in partnership with a Foresight studio called From Later. You'd probably be interested in talking to them. I'm happy to make an introduction. So we're hopefully going to be offering, I think, 2 modules in the fall and then 2 in the spring-ish, summer maybe, I don't know. The timing's to be determined.
Are these projects all funded by the government?
No. Are they funded by the government? What is being funded? Nothing's currently, what is being funded? We exist on a project-by-project basis. The lab is funded by me, which is to say that we are very poor. I've been lucky that I've built up a consulting practice, and so that has been resourcing, like it's really been filling in the gaps. For the Newcomers Project, we had a major grant this last year. Currently, we don't have a new grant for the upcoming year, but knock on wood, we think that, you know, there's stuff. There's always, this is the thing about doing art or any kind of itinerant work, is that you always have to have lots of balls in the air and things in play. It's not just
to make it financially feasible, but it's actually, in my opinion, to make it emotionally tenable. You need to always feel like there's something hopeful on the horizon. That said, it's also a balance to make sure that you are celebrating and really appreciating, savoring the work that you want to do when you get the money, instead of always being out there chasing for more money. And so that's a good rule of thumb also for when you should just plain make do with less, because the most important part is whether your soul is intact, whether your heart is intact, and the rest follows. I say that from a position of privilege, I understand, but that happens to be my value set, or to whatever extent that helps someone else to hear that, I just want to share it for that reason, not to say that, you know, there are all kinds of challenges out there. So going back to how are we resourced, we are applying for money for the work with Black Lives Matter. We are waiting to hear about money for the creative practice work, but it is going to be partly resourced by a residency that I've secured with the University of Toronto Scarborough campus. They've invited us to be in residence this coming school year. And then what was the other thing I said that we were doing? Oh, the immigration work. Yes, I'm waiting to hear about that. And then we are also working on a audience research piece. That's more of a consulting project. That is a consulting project. We're doing it in partnership, so we're not getting paid a lot, but it's interesting work to me. But yeah, that kind of work, so-called for-profit work, helps fill in the gaps as well.
Can you tell me more about your consulting practice?
What would you like to know?
So what is it that you're consulting? Like what sort of consultancy, what kind of issues or problem that you're consulting for?
These days it's a lot on impact evaluation, I think, but also just research. If people don't know about something, I think that this is not the official, this is not how I pitch it, but what I've noticed, the pattern across all the different things that I've asked to do, is that when people don't know what they want to do or don't know how to do or don't know what they should be doing, they call me. Yeah, I'm just a person who sorts things out. And I'm also not, I wouldn't pretend to know things that I don't know, or that I wouldn't pretend to be an expert on things that I know perfectly well, that there are people who, you know, for whom it's their bread and butter. So I do get asked to do equity work, and like, it's not my bread and butter. There are situations where it makes sense for me to be an intermediary, but it's not my domain. There was a time when I did that kind of work, but yeah, I just think, and so what I mean is, people trust me to let them know when I'm not the right person, but they can reach out and connect with me, and I can tell them, well, this is what you need to be thinking about, and I can help you with that, or I'm not the person to help you with that. You should talk to so-and-so.
Interesting. So it's kind of helping someone make sense of a situation.
Mm-hmm.
Sense making. There is also like a large chunk of work that you do with NGOs and nonprofit. I wonder what's the link, how you ended up, like what your journey was like towards the nonprofit. Like, surely there must have been some sort of work that you were doing that led you to the nonprofits, or that the nonprofits were led to you, or, you know, like
are part of the nonprofit world, so I don't see them as being separate. Actually, again, it was Ginny Stoke. So she was, I don't remember, executive director, I guess that was her title. She's the executive director of Creative Trust, which was that company that, you know, ran those professional organizational development workshops that I went to back at CSI way back when. And she you know, I think she had a dance background. I'm not sure, but she was the first chair of the Ontario Nonprofit Network. And then I invited, she invited me in at some point to the ONN as an advisory member. I attended a few meetings, and then they would call me every year when they were doing a conference being like, how do we engage artists? And I would be really excited about telling them how, and then it would turn out that they would just really want some sort of thing. Like, I don't want to say a dazzle, like it wasn't like, you know, it wasn't quite that superficial, but they would just want some sort of like artistic intervention at the beginning or end or somewhere. And like, it was just an activation of some kind, which is not to say that that's not good too, but it just, what I wanted was much, much further. But you know, you just, I stayed in touch with those people. And it's led on to other things like, or just conversations. Nothing's actually ever, I don't think anything's ever actually resulted in money, but it's kept me part of that conversation. So I mean, I hope that answers your question of how did I get connected. I mean, first of all, we belong in the nonprofit sector. Mm-hmm. And so when I've sat in on committees, so I've been on the advisory committee for the evaluation strategy for the sector, and also currently I serve on the, I guess it's a decent work committee, and they're always thrilled to hear about about the arts perspective, and oftentimes, you know, it's good. It's good to just bring up, well, how does this work for the arts sector, and what does this mean, mm-hmm. you know, and it's a good test for, you know, these theories or these frameworks that we come up with. Does it work for the arts? Mm-hmm. You were just that, yeah. So was that your question? It was like, how did I get connected?
Yeah.
On the sustainability question, I think that is something that can, you know, that is a question for all of us. I do think alternative economies are the way. I really think that mutual aid on a large scale, or on a, in a distributed network, is really where we need to go. It's and I see it happening. I have a great belief in I have a belief in people and systems and the human spirit and in creativity itself, and life finds a way. So I think it's happening.
If you can say to people one thing they can do that can create change, what would that be?
One thing that people can do to create change. I guess I have two answers to that. One is to live your questions. Once again, I would say live them in a way that, you know, that doesn't do harm to others or to yourself. So live your questions. And the other thing is be willing to do humble things. I think that people really underestimate how much of change work and nonprofit work and social innovation work actually should be really, like, what people need are actually really, really simple things. And if we just did those instead of trying to, that was my phone. We just need to do really simple acts of assistance for other people, for people who are not like you and not like me. That is where change comes.
Thank you. If people would like to find out more about you and what you do, where can they go?
I have my own website, helenyoung.com. That's HELENYUNG. There's no O. And we also have artisticintelligence.com for the laboratory's work, which is really, there's crossover, but
thank you for your time. Thank you for your patience. Thank you for sharing.
Thank you. Thank you. It's great to meet you, and it's great to know what you're doing. And I apologize, I wasn't more prepared for this. I should have asked you for the questions in advance. They're so big and lofty. Not lofty, big. They're big and complex. That's what I mean. I look forward to staying in touch.
Yes, me too. Thank you. Hey everyone, thank you for listening. Special thanks to Andrea for the music. If you liked what you heard, be sure to subscribe. We're on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and Google Play. Catch you next episode.